There's no question that the formation of the European Union was an inspirational move, certainly a courageous one, evolving from the ashes of the devastation of World War II. The fact that these nations, which had previously been warring, decided to come together and build common institutions, share common values, such as respect for democracy and human rights, even tear down the odd border, made it all the more inspiring. For my next guest, who grew up under Greece's neo-fascist dictatorship, the reign of the colonels from 67 to 74, a European Union had great appeal. However, the 2008 GFC, the manner in which it has been handled by the EU, has brought the notion of a continued united Europe into question. Professor Yanis Varoufakis is my guest. He's Professor of Economics from the University of Athens and visiting professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. Normally at this point, I would ask the good professor to tell us who the hell Lyndon B. Johnson was, but I have a vague memory of that bloke. And tomorrow evening, that's Wednesday night, 23rd of October, Yanis will present the inaugural University of Western Sydney's Europe Lecture at the State Library of New South Wales. His topic, yes, the dirty war for Europe's integrity and soul. Sitting with me in studio, give me a preview.
At the beginning, there was the GFC, as you put it. We could have started much earlier, but let's start in 2008. Now, that magnificent earthquake of a planetary scale was not the kind of earthquake that the Eurozone was designed to sustain. So just like 1929 started the process of the unraveling of the common currency of that era, which was a gold standard, similarly 2008 put the Eurozone under enormous pressure and began that process of disintegration. Now, Europe's great and good. Instead of accepting that there was a systemic crisis that needed to be dealt with systematically, went into denial mode. And underneath that denial, I'm very much afraid, there lurked a sinister motive. And that was how to transfer banking losses from the books of the French and the German banks onto the taxpayers, which is, of course, what had happened in the United States at the same time.
I've got a dangerous firebrand sitting here in the studio. Heavens above. What an heretical view.
Well, let me give you an example of this, if I may. Greece borrowed the largest amount of money in the history of humankind from Europe and from the IMF over the last 4 years. More than something like 300 billion Australian dollars. It's a mountain of money, of which it retained 3%. The rest went to the banks. This is why I'm talking about a transfer.
Sorry, run that past me again.
300 billion Australian dollars.
Got that, I've written that
of
down.
Which the Greek state retained 3%. The rest went to the banks.
We saw the similar transfer of money, of course, in Wall Street.
Absolutely. But the United States of America, the dollar zone, has a solidity. It's a federal system. So take the state of Nevada, let's say, which is equivalent in terms of size to Ireland. And a similar economy to Ireland, too. Imagine what would have happened in 2008 if the state of Nevada had to find the money to bail out the banks of Nevada and the money to pay the unemployment benefits following the collapse of the real estate sector there. What would have happened, of course, is that the state of Nevada and the private sector of Nevada would have gone bankrupt.
Okay. I just want to clarify one thing. How did you initially view the idea of the European Union, given your experiences in the Greece of the colonels?
As we were emerging from those dark ages in the 60s and 70s, Europe was a beacon on the hill. It was the light that was shining brightly in that darkness of ours. It was an escape from Orientalism, from irrationality, from tyranny. And regardless of whether you were from the left or the right, even though the left had a very sort of negative attitude towards the European Union, even that, though that was the case, we were all looking upon the European Union just like, I suppose, people, you know, in Eastern Europe, on the other side of the Iron Curtain, two decades later, were looking upon Europe as a kind of...
Yeah, same sort of hope was invested in it as in the United Nations, another flawed structure. But we wanted it to work.
Well, the European Union harbored a lot more promise than the United Nations, particularly for the people of Europe, for one very simple reason. It offered the prospect of shared prosperity that the United Nations didn't really offer. The United Nations offered the prospect of global governance, but not of shared prosperity.
Now, Yanis, you see the problem with the EU Monetary Union, or one of the problems being its dependence on the US economy.
Well, we Europeans love to live our myth, and the greatest and the most toxic of these myths is that the European Union was a European invention. It was not. It was Washington, right at the end of the Second World War, which effectively banged various French and German heads together and forced them, incited them to come together into what we now know as the European Union. The European Union was always predicated upon a global order that kept the European Union viable between the early 1950s and 2008. And unfortunately, in 2008, the United States lost the capacity to provide that stability for the European Union.
I don't know how these people get on the program. Sitting opposite me is the firebrand Yanis Varoufakis, who's a director of the Political Economy Division at the University of Athens. Was. Well, they woke up to you, see, and a visiting professor at the University of Texas under the auspices of that fine fellow, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Okay. How do you explain the unwillingness of politicians, not simply European politicians, to challenge bankers at this time?
Well, there was a very cozy relationship between politicians and bankers before the crisis.
Bit like a financial variation on the military-industrial complex. Everyone was locked in together, scratching each other's backs.
Well, that's quite right. But what is of particular interest to me in Europe is the relationship between social democratic politicians and the bankers. Back in the 1960s and early 70s, social democrats like Willy Brandt in Germany, Bruno Kreisky in Austria, they fought a good fight to convince, to persuade industrialists to share part of their surpluses and therefore to fund the welfare states. But with the commencement of what we all refer to these days as financialization, well-meaning social democrats in Europe, including in Britain, Tony Blair, in this sense, well-meaning, thought that it was much simpler to fund the welfare state by dipping into the profits of the financial sector in a kind of a Faustian bargain with the bankers, whereby the bankers would be allowed to run riot. And some morsels of their table would be used to fund the welfare state. Once that kind of relationship was forged, and it was forged almost everywhere, in Germany, in Italy, in Greece, in Britain, the welfare state was being funded to a large extent through the super profits of the financial sector. By the time the banks collapsed as a result of that feeding frenzy of theirs, I believe that our politicians had lost both the moral authority and the analytical skills to counter the bankers.
Now, of course, Germany has always thumped the table, says it won't pay for the debts of the southern nations. But what was the nature of Germany's reluctance to resist anything to remedy the crisis other than austerity?
I think that the pivotal moment between 2008-2009 was that when the German, not just government, but the German political system decided to deny, to enter into a very deep denial that there was a problem with the way that the Eurozone was constructed. You see, if you deny that there was a systemic problem, then you have to deal it as a debt crisis. And then you have to explain the crisis by identifying, you know, the Greeks as profligate, the Irish as playing fast and loose with real estate. And then you lose sight of the system of the Eurozone. Then it becomes a separate crisis in Ireland, a separate crisis in Portugal. And then, once you reach that point, then the only thing you can do is you can say to your own parliamentarians in the federal parliament in Berlin, you can say, look, okay, they've been the grasshoppers during the summer months. Now, what we need to do is we need to deliver some tough love. So,
the grasshopper is, of course, one of the great Greek myths, isn't it? Stories.
And one that has been used in a toxic manner in Europe as we speak. This idea that you have the ants of the north and the grasshoppers of the periphery is doing untold damage to the prospects of the European Union because it is such a bad metaphor.
I want to mention a name which causes both of us physical pain, Margaret Thatcher, who was, of course, the greatest Eurosceptic, and it saw her ousting when she opposed the Commission's plans for political integration. And Britain remains, you know, divided over Europe. Was Thatcher right?
As someone who spent his youth picketing and demonstrating against Mrs. Thatcher in Britain, I'm loath to say that she was spot on. her error regarding the Eurozone was not that the Eurozone was sustainable. It was not sustainable as she very much feared. Her error, and you may recall her final parliamentary speech in which she said that monetary union in Europe has one purpose and one purpose alone, to bring federation through the back door. She was wrong on that. And now we can see that. There was never any plan by Mitterrand, by Helmut Kohl, or currently for Europe to federate.
How do you measure public opinion in Europe now from Greece across that vast tract of territory? Are people now becoming Eurosceptics?
Oh, absolutely. You don't have to believe me on this. The European Union has its own polls, its own statistics on, you know, they constantly take the pulse of public opinion in Europe, and the figures are dramatic. Whereas once upon a time the European Union was bathed with acceptance and even appreciation and love by most Europeans, the Spanish, the Germans, and so on, now large majorities have declared no confidence in European Union institutions.
Dear, dear, dear. Now, I want you to tell me a story about the VAT in Portugal. I find this a really interesting anecdote. It was increased when the officials knew it would reduce public revenues.
Well, let me tell you my story with regard to that. I was in Brussels and I was talking to one of the commissioners of the European Commission, one of the high priests of the Union. And as a second-rate economist, which is what I am, I put it to him that simple economic logic tells us that an economy which is in free fall, if you increase VAT, you know, sales tax, massively, what will happen is that sales are going to go through the floor. A lot of economic transactions are going to go under the table, under the counter, and the state is going to lose revenue. So given the stated purpose of this increase in sales tax, which was, of course, to reduce deficits and debt, was that counterproductive? Similarly with fuel tax in Greece, and this was a question I put to him. And he looked at me and he gave me, quite unexpectedly as far as I was concerned, a very honest answer. He said, "You're quite right, but you don't understand. This is a deterrent." And I asked him, "What do you mean a deterrent? For what?" "Well, this is sending a signal to Rome and to Madrid so that they know what's coming their way if they do not introduce the reforms and the various austerity measures that we are expecting of them." So you have, you know, you have what I call fiscal waterboarding of whole proud nations as a deterrent for other proud nations.
I liked your phrase about Ponzi growth morphing into Ponzi austerity.
Well, we all know what Ponzi growth is. I mean, the fuel-debted growth in Ireland, in Spain, in Greece, these torrents of capital that were flowing from the German banks and the French banks to the periphery that created this Ponzi growth. Once that, those bubbles burst, then we move to Ponzi austerity. And let me give you a very simple just example, because that's the best way of describing it. A year and a half ago, there was a moment when the Greek government was shut off, both from the markets, couldn't borrow from anyone, and it wasn't being given any of the loan tranches from the European Union, because there was an impending election, and the opinion polls were saying that an anti-bailout party might have won. So Greece was completely cut off. And yet, there was a debt that we had to the European Central Bank. Let me not explain why that was, but it doesn't matter. So the way we did it, we were asked to repay it, is by having the Greek government, which was insolvent, borrow from the insolvent Greek banks. And where did they find the money since we were insolvent? They took IOUs from the Greek government, gave them to the European Central Bank to take money to give to the Greek government so that the Greek government could repay the European Central Bank. If this is not a Ponzi scheme, I do not know what it is.
Yiannis, we've got to sort out the Australian Constitution, so I've got time for one more question, and I'd like you to answer it with, as briefly as you can. You're calling for a decentralised Europeanisation. What the hell is that?
It's the only thing we can do at the moment to save Europe, to save the European Union. If we keep going the way we are, it's going to hit the rocks. We can't federate because this crisis has created centrifugal forces that are pushing the Germans against the Greeks against the Germans, very soon the Greeks against the Greeks and so on. The idea of decentralized Europeanization is very simple. We can unify the things that need to be unified without federation and without loss of sovereignty. So we can unify the banking systems. It's ludicrous to have separate banking systems. We can unify part of the public debt of Europe. And we can have a New Deal kind of investment policy that is executed by one of our existing institutions, the European Investment Bank. Now, these things, Europeanize debt, the banking troubles, as well as in aggregate investment. And it is done without loss of sovereignty. It enhances democratic control of the process. And it Europeanizes these problems that need to be Europeanized.
You've been affected by this very personally. I understand you had to leave Greece.
That's quite right, for a variety of reasons. One was that everything that I tried to create at the University of Athens, undergraduate and postgraduate programs collapsed under the pressure of the economic calamity. Being embroiled in debates that were quite sterile didn't help. And let me put it very sort of diplomatically, I must have stepped on the toes of various bankrupt bankers who were very keen to continue receiving bailout loans. And in the middle of the night, we had certain unpleasant phone calls that occasioned my wife to say, either you go into politics or we get out of the country.
If you're in Sydney, you can catch Yiannis Varoufakis tomorrow night at the State Library of New South Wales between 6 and 8 in the Dixon Room. And it's tonight, of course, if you're listening to the repeat. If you're unable to attend, you can hear his full speech afterwards on RN's Big Ideas program on Wednesday the 30th of October at 8. That's RN next Wednesday at 8 p.m. Thank you, Yiannis. Coming up, what needs to happen to our constitution, LNL, on RN.